What's up, everybody? My name is John Campioni. I am a chiropractic physician and a rock tape instructor. Today, I have with me Brett Sanders. Brett has a Master's of Science in Occupational Therapy, as well as a Bachelor of Science degree from Springfield College. He's been an occupational therapist for 20 years and has treated a variety of settings, ranging from operating rooms to manufacturing floors. He began his career as a staff therapist, treating hands, burns, and providing acute care at St. Agnes Medical Center in Philadelphia. He joined NovaCare Rehabilitation in 1999 as a hand specialist, moving quickly to expand his specialties to include ergonomics, job analyses, and testing. Brett, what's up?
Hey, John, how are you?
I'm great, man. Thank you so much for being on. Peek behind the curtain for everybody listening. As we record this, I am in Detroit. I literally just got into my hotel room, and Brett is in Charlotte, right?
I am in Charlotte, yeah. Just got into my hotel room a little bit before you.
We are both teaching this weekend, so we're grinding it down just so we can get a nice, fun interview in there.
Awesome.
So, Brett, I am so happy to have you on because I don't think we've got a chance to really talk to an occupational therapist, and more than anything, too, from your intro, hand specialist. This is something that I don't feel I have a lot of education on personally, and there's a lot of like tape questions in particular about hands that I have for you. But really what I'd like to start out with just about everybody is what really got you started with Rock Tape, and really how did you come in to join the company? So tell us, when did you start with Rock Tape?
So I started almost 3 years ago going to an actual course with John Canuto, who used to be an instructor for us. And he revisited taping with me because I had taken a KT course, I'll say 15 years ago. And I was really excited. I thought this was the best thing since sliced bread. I got my first patient. It was a shoulder patient. It took me 15 minutes to figure out on the manual through the actual process, how I was actually going to tape the shoulder, origin to insertion. I put it on. Active range of motion went well. They said a reduction in pain was really pretty solid. And then the tape came off like 2 seconds later. I threw the manual away. I threw tape away and hadn't come back to it since. So
how many years was it until you got back into it with Rock Tape?
It was probably 12 years until revisited kinesiology tape again, with the advent of Rock Tape and, something that would actually stick to skin, which is amazing, right?
It's so amazing. That is the common story I hear from me. I swear, it's not even hyperbole. I swear everybody says that's how they got into Rock Tape. It actually stayed on.
Yeah. And the process, you know, debunking the idea that origin to insertion and it just, you're not turning on and off muscles. And yeah. It's like, I had asked the question in the course, they said, well, what happens when you tape something like the wrist or the ankle, when there are so many origin insertions? They said, go with the major muscles and don't think so much about it.
This is in the previous course that you had?
Yeah. KT, you know, an eons ago.
Don't you love that when they're like, well, just don't think so hard about it.
They didn't have an answer. They did not have an answer. Yeah. And now we know.
You got back into tape with John. And again, you know, we bring you in with the stickiness and we keep you with the education. What really appealed to you with the education? You had mentioned, you know, it kind of debunked a lot of the different theories that had been out there. And it sounds like it made the application process a lot more easy for you.
It was easy. It was fun. And, you know, look, when you do it in the class and you have results immediately, it's almost a no-brainer. I mean, it's like it was fun again. And it got me thinking to be I was really a little upset at first because I'm like, oh, my God, I've done such a disservice to like so many patients. I could have helped that much better if I had used tape then. But, you know, you have to get over that and just move forward as a clinician, because that's why they call it practicing medicine, right? It's not, there's no guarantees.
So you've been practicing for quite some time. You know, huge variety of, different settings, different types of patients. How did you really start to integrate, kinesiology tape into the fold? Or maybe a better question would be when you first started using kinesiology tape, which was back with, previous education, why did you want to start bringing that into the fold?
Well, I was really looking for something else. I wanted to kind of differentiate myself, be a better clinician. I mean, always trying to learn is certainly something that I think a lot of people that come to our Rock Tape courses are interested in doing, is just being a better clinician, being, you know, helping more patients, being better at helping patients, clients, whoever it is that you're working with. But honestly, I got into taping again because I was working with a major online retailer. Okay, it's the biggest online retailer, and you probably have boxes coming to your door. And we were doing something called early symptom intervention. And the workers' comp population is basically what I've been working with for the last 18 years, almost exclusively. So whether it was treating on-site or doing a variety of different programs that we offer. With this online retailer, I was having to not only come up with a product that was usable, but that would happen and work day after day. And again, one application, 3 to 5 days, I was hooked. Really this online retailer is that begins with an A and is a river in a different country. Literally, people are coming off the street and having to walk 8 or 12 miles a day and shopping essentially for your products or boxing them up. So their overuse injuries were ridiculous and still are, honestly. But we came to them and this was one of the tools that we were going to use to not have it be recordable. So they didn't have to go to the doctor. Workers' comp claims didn't, you know, flare up. And it's worked really well. And
so were you kind of getting to them before they were necessarily evaluated and given a diagnosis?
Absolutely. Yep. Okay. It's called triage, and they had EMTs doing it. And then we ended up bringing in athletic trainers, and I was managing 5 different locations in 5 different states, from Pennsylvania all the way to California.
Wow.
Educating them how to actually do the triage, and because it's a lot different than working with somebody on the field. But again, the skills, the actual skills in doing the work, working with a person, are exactly the same. It's just a different field that you're talking about. So yeah,
that's really cool to think about that too. I love how you put that. I think we take that for granted quite a bit, is you make an order and then someone is literally going through aisles with a cart. Order, and then eventually shipping it off to you. With that kind of work, you had said how many miles in a day are these?
Between 8 and 12 miles. That's what it used to be, and okay. Their technology has improved. Now the shelves are coming to the person because a robot is picking up the shelf and bringing it to them. So even then, they're still having to climb ladders and reach, squat. It doesn't matter. The injuries are still happening. So
what was the common type of injury? You had mentioned overuse injuries. Are there particular patterns that you saw, or was it kind of across the board?
Wrist, shoulder, knees, backs, feet. I mean, look, these people come in and they're like, my feet are killing me. I'm like, well, you're wearing Uggs. So, and you're walking 12 miles. I can't imagine why you would have foot pain. There's no support. It's like, why not wear your slippers in? And they were. So, it's fascinating. It was just really amazing to, and you have a huge impact. It's an immediate impact.
That's something that's, I hate to say overlooked, but I think it really is workers' comp takes away from a company's bottom line when the worker can't work, obviously. And then that does inhibit the worker from working, obviously. So there's a lot of problems that come with these very common injuries that come up. So, you know, what are some of the different tips and things that you would recommend to corporations and just really, you know, small businesses that have employees to make sure that they're staying healthy and staying off the injured list?
The hardest thing is early reporting. I mean, honestly, if we don't know you have a problem, it festers, and then you are in extreme pain, and by then it's too late to really help. Yes, and that's the hardest part, and it ends up being a culture. It's a cultural thing. Literally, within the company, there is a culture of either early reporting, or you're going to be seen as a black sheep if you report your injury. And by the time you have to, it's too late. And it certainly is worse than it would have been if you were to just address it sooner rather than later. So
it's kind of a shame that to have that mentality, but it's nice to have, you know, programs like yours to really improve upon that intervention. Are you doing a lot of ergonomic work with these type of workers, teaching them how to lift, or are you really just kind of addressing things as they come along?
No, it's half of it is their treatment. And I don't want to call it treatment. It's triage. Mm-hmm. And again, if you look up what OSHA is for a while, for about a year, 1 year period between 2013 and 2014, kinesiology tape was considered a recordable because it was put on by a quote unquote professional. Mm-hmm. And again, we still promote it being put on by professionals, but again, we talk about it being able to be purchased in any store, in the grocery store next to your ham and your eggs. So it's almost been declassified, so to speak. But so OSHA basically considers it an acceptable treatment for just like ice or, again, heat, mm-hmm. like a Band-Aid, splinter removal, massage. Those are all under what's considered not an OSHA recordable. So mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been really very interesting to be able to make changes within a company. And again, it is their bottom line. And I keep saying we should be taking a percentage of what we'd save them on their workers' comp. But I work for Select Medical. We have the largest outpatient physical and occupational therapy company in the U.S. at this point, with like over 1,600 clinics across the U.S. and 44 states, 45 states. So, so it's pretty interesting.
Very cool. You know, overall, as an occupational therapist, how do you feel the profession as a whole has really accepted things like kinesiology tape and the tools, and maybe even if you want to allude to what you're teaching this weekend with Floss and Pods?
Well, I'll have to say I'm always a little bit different than most of the. I can't certainly speak for all the occupational therapists, but I'm a little bit different. I mean, and I'm gonna get off topic a little bit, but when I tell people what I do, they say, "Well, what do you do?" And I'm like, "There used to be an old program on Discovery called Dirty Jobs by Mike Rowe."
Oh, I love that show.
That's me without the film crew. I mean, if people call on me to help resolve their workers' comp issues, and I have to figure out what they do. So I may be evaluating a job, figuring out what people have to lift, carry, push, and pull, document it so we can make a post-offer test, document it so a lawyer can use it, a physician, HR, because honestly, you look at a job description and people have no idea what that means and what you actually physically do.
Yeah.
I've worked in a meat packing plant, a pork packing plant. People come up to you for treatment, and I was doing on-site therapy. They come up to you, you know, there's blood and guts everywhere. They stink. And you've got to treat the person because they're in pain. With the airline industry, which is fascinating, people would come right off the tarmac, right into my office and, at the airport. So, climbing poles, you name it. It's been a fun ride so far, but it's enjoyable.
That's pretty amazing. It's nice to be kind of right there also. And, you know,
it is, I can see exactly what they're doing wrong. And again, it's like if I was in a clinic, I'd never be able to figure this stuff out. And that's why I'm like, I think it's cheating almost. But honestly, on-site therapy has fallen a little bit out of favor.
Sure.
I still enjoy being on-site and being able to have that effect.
Well, that's a really interesting point is you know, me as a clinician who has a office, people come to me and then they have to explain what's going
right
on with them. I'm almost at a disadvantage when you compare to what you've got, because you are actually quite literally watching these people as they move and saying, "Ooh, yeah, I saw what you're talking about.
Yeah.
What's going on?
Now I know why you hurt." And then you educate them on proper body mechanics and trying to, whether it's, you know, most of the time it's not equipment that you're instituting, but, sometimes it's, here, utilize this kneeling pad. but mostly it's proper body mechanics, lifting, changing. When I talk about the root cause, it's even within our classes that we teach, figure out the root cause, because you need to educate them on how to improve their function so they don't keep doing the same thing wrong.
Yeah. And I think across a lot of the manual therapies, manual medicine, we talk a ton about ergonomics and lifting techniques and anything like that. As someone who specializes in that, is there anything that you can possibly debunk when people talk about ergonomics or lifting techniques, things that might be told that aren't necessarily true or something that might need to be refined?
That's a tough question. I think the biggest thing is people's lifting techniques. I just did a program this week that we partnered with probably one of the biggest cable companies in the U.S. They're based in Philadelphia. And they laugh when you try to explain to them how to lift correctly. and it's amazing. And I said, look, you have to spread your feet apart. You're not wearing a skirt. And if you were, hopefully it's going to cover things. But you have to spread your feet apart and have the mass literally between your feet to lift correctly. Keep your back straight. I mean, look, everybody can whisper and tell you how to lift correctly, but in practice, it honestly doesn't happen.
What's the right way to ask that is how receptive are a lot of these workers to a lot of the tips? It seems like this is something that is actually growing out quite a bit, whereas I could see, you know, in previous generations, in previous years, is a lot of these quote-unquote tough guys and gals possibly be like, I'm fine. I don't really need to just do your magic tape and then let me get back to work kind of thing. Do they respond well now to a lot of this ergonomic training?
I think they are. It's a slow process, but those that have been hurt really want to pay attention and listen and make changes. Mm-hmm. The young bucks, as we'll say, really couldn't give a crap at this point. they laugh and they're talking and they're joking and they are invincible until they're not, right?
Sure. Yeah.
But really, honestly, most of the time, people that I see are fairly receptive to making changes because they've the aging workforce. That's every employer's complaint is that, you know, I don't know when you and I can retire, but it's certainly not going to be anytime soon. We're going to work till we're 90 if we can, and not because we want to, because we still have bills to pay. So. Yeah, it's fascinating. I mean, the everybody's going to keep working until they can't anymore. So, yeah.
I'm just going to be sitting in a wheelchair telling people about decompression.
No, you won't.
It's too much stretch on the tape. So, throughout your career, you've been kind of known as a hand specialist. And I really got to talk to you a lot about the hand because I think the hand is one of those difficult things to really treat. And I personally feel it's overlooked. I use the analogy a lot in my courses where I take a towel or a band and I have someone hold one end and I start twisting it from the other end. And you notice how the twisting of the fabric or the band, it starts to climb up the length of that, whatever you're using, towel or band. And
sure.
I use that as an example of this is why we need to treat the hands, because if I get fascial binding or problems or injury in my hand, it's going to lead all the way up that chain and start to affect the shoulder, the spine, everything like that too. And I think we get overlooked when we have, you know, I kind of consider myself just a general practitioner. I kind of just treat everything. I don't have a body specialty, but a lot of times when people talk about hand and treating the hands, they think about occupational therapy. And I think this is something that's not really looked at a ton. So I'd love to hear kind of your tips and tricks that you use with treating the hand, some of the things that you notice in therapies and the associations with hand and other conditions.
Yeah. So it's interesting because I get hand clinicians that want to know a ton about and do we have time when we're covering the whole body? And honestly, I'm one of the OTs that's fairly rare that are just as comfortable treating the foot as I am the hand, because again, I think they do the same exact thing. We just walk on one and touch stuff with the other, but
you're right.
Yeah. Right. It's my,
I flip it around sometimes.
Right. exactly. So I was actually able to sit for the CHT exam and decided that it was going to be too much of an effort, not only studying, but by the time I actually got around to it, my clinical instructor unfortunately passed away of a massive heart attack in her driveway cleaning snow off her car. So,
oh my gosh,
I didn't have anybody to validate my hours. Because you need like 2,000 hours of direct supervision to sit for the exam, or at least you did then. And it wasn't worth the monetary value of the effort. So I didn't. But I still worked as a hand specialist. Honestly, with taping, I am really less likely to make a splint now than ever. I had a thumb avulsion fracture 2 years ago. I had a splint on. I wore only at night because the tape helped so much. And honestly, for de Quer veins, we had a little discussion a couple days ago that the de Quer veins taping application that I do is so good that a positive Finkelstein's test almost goes away.
Wow.
And I think rigid splints really restrict your movement, and of course, that's what it's supposed to do, but you're fighting the splint, which again continues to aggravate the tendonitis aspect of the thumb. So, it's fascinating how things change, but there are some significant tape applications that really help. It's just a little bit more of a challenge, some finer cutting depending on this person's size of their hand and what their diagnosis is. But yeah, some cool stuff you can do.
Well, I mean, you kind of said it a little earlier too, is the hand's very much like the foot. And, you know, we are seeing now there's, I don't want to say a pushback. Everything has its place, but you're seeing that people are, or at least the general practitioners are kind of moving away from orthotics. We don't necessarily always want to brace the foot.
Correct.
Might be necessary. It's possible. So you're seeing the same thing with hands is kind of avoiding the splinting and using things like elastic tape, kinesiology tape to help improve the conditions that you're seeing.
That's personally my shift. And I think some of the hand surgeons, and again, I'm not directly involved with hand injuries and hand rehab on a daily basis anymore. I think people are more open to it. And again, if it's working, let's use it. Is more the approach many people, clinicians and physicians, patients are taking. So, it's pretty.
I've always had trouble with taping the hands. We have great tape. We know stickiest tape on the market. It stays on great, but the hands have always given me trouble personally because we use our hands. You know, if you're like me, you wash your hands quite a bit throughout the day as well, too. And, you know, even our awesome tape with several hand washings or even several soakings, the tape is going to start to kind of peel off. Do you have any little tips and tricks, things that you like to do that helps keep that hand, that tape on the hand? Is it something you might tell the patient?
I kind of think obviously washing your hands is going to be super important, but oftentimes that doesn't get off the grease that your hand naturally produces. So some alcohol prep pads certainly help. And I try to stay off of the palmar surfaces if at all possible. I mean, if you think about the hand, there are a lot of it's tendons, but most of it is based on the forearm, right? I mean, so yeah. Grip is all forearm based, grip, wrist extension, flexion, unless you're talking about the lumbricals or a specific finger injury. I think some of the tendonitis applications we have for medial and lateral epicondylitis are really good. And I've personally dealt with, some medial epicondylitis from playing collegiate tennis. I wasn't really good. So that's why I had epicondylitis, but.
And you also had the wrong kind of epicondylitis.
Right? Yeah, exactly. I had golfer's elbow from playing tennis. What does that mean? Yes. I was really bad at playing tennis. Good enough to make the team. But, so my first serve never went in, if you really want to know the truth. So I would have to spin my second serve in, which was grip the racket as hard as you can because you're sweating, and then spin it in, which is a lot of wrist flexion, right? So, yeah, that was my only weapon. And that's why it still bugs me to this day, which the floss really helps with. So
okay,
it's really unbelievable. I mean, I can do some stuff or chores around the house. It's unbelievable. It doesn't take really much at all to flare up my medial epicondylitis. The flossing is unbelievable. It really, really is super helpful.
So you're kind of saying with a lot of hand injuries, things that you're seeing, more common ones, is really address the forearm muscles, as that's what's heading into the wrist and hand and moving it. So you're not necessarily taping the hand specifically, unless it's pun intended, handful of cases.
Yes. And no, obviously I do tape the hand, depending on the diagnosis.
Sure.
You know, the gauntlet for that I utilize for even carpal tunnel, I'm going through the fingers, putting it across the palm and the back of the hand. And, you know, obviously I'm taping the hand. But yes, a lot of what I do is trying to avoid the washable surfaces of the skin, if at all possible, on the hand.
That's a great, because I think a lot of people, it's very difficult. And I had the exact same problem, is I wasn't thinking that. Like, I know all the anatomy, I know how it all functions. But, you know, when somebody tells me they have pain in their hands, and I'm like, oh God, the tape's not going to stay on the hand. But yeah, let's look a little bit more distally and let's go back to what's going on with the forearms and things like that. So you mentioned floss on the elbow. I have to agree with you there. I love flossing the elbows there. How have you seen in the introduction of new tools like the floss being utilized, and how it's being received with patients, and the different outcomes you're getting with the type of populations that you see?
So obviously there's the latex that you need to discuss with the person first. You have to know their personality as well. When you floss somebody, it is a little uncomfortable. Yeah. Okay, maybe a lot uncomfortable, depending on the person and how tight you're wrapping it. Again, I think if you have the right person, it's really nothing better than utilizing. And obviously, I'm telling you because I do it personally on myself. And there's a significant reduction. If that's the only treatment I do, I really get some significant relief. I think it has to be the right person. Can you do it with every patient? No, but can you do it with 50 or 60% of the patients? Yeah. The elderly are obviously going to have a little bit more of an issue. Even, honestly, it has to be the right female. I wouldn't even suggest it on, probably a third or a quarter of the female patients that I have, just 'cause I know their personality. I already know a lot about them. I'll give it as an offer and I'll let them touch it, feel it. We can do 25%, but are you going to have enough of an actual functional mechanical stimulus happening to make an improvement? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'd rather do something else. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah. Do you have trouble with, you know, you had mentioned, and I guess maybe this is a very specific example. You'd mentioned the meatpacking, and you're, you know, seeing people on site, there's blood and guts everywhere. They've probably got some on them a little bit as well too. So I have to imagine, like, things like tape and even the pods, things are going right on the skin. You know, you can kind of get around it with floss. What are you using to really make sure that you're cleaning off the skin surface in such a nitty-gritty type of environment?
Well, obviously soap and water is your key and your go-to. And again, a lot of it, they're taking off clothes, depending on what part of the process they are in. Sure. Some guys are in a freezer suit. So, and they're never getting off a vehicle. Others are just, you know, they're all gowned up, and then they never let go of the knife. I mean, so it really depends on what part of the plant you're treating. So, a lot of the OTs that I deal with are like, we've got a trigger finger. Can you use tape? And I'm like, I wish it would work, but it really doesn't. And you kind of, you review the anatomy with the clinician and say, look, it's really just not, it's not going to work. And it doesn't stick very well to the palm. So, when you just have a knife in your hand and it's cold and they never let go of that knife, again, part of it's habit, part of it's, you know, how old they are and anatomy.
So you're with trigger finger, what you were saying with the tape not working, you're just saying that it's probably not going to stay on.
It's not going to stay on. And technically, if you have a tendon getting stuck through a pulley system, are you really, because of scar tissue, are you really going to have an effect on, you know, decompressing that area? Probably not. I tell people you should try it, but I'd say you probably have a 25% chance of it helping.
Sure.
For multiple reasons, but primarily because it doesn't stick as well, and the actual biomechanical issue that's happening.
Yeah, I mean, we say it all the time. If the tape doesn't stick, it can't do what it's supposed to do. That's the whole point of why a lot of people are finding rock tape. Like, hey, it sticks, and then let's teach you how we're doing it.
Right on.
So how about working with the tools? Do you get a chance to be using the tools on site with a lot of these different cases?
I do, and I'm honestly treating a little less. I'm teaching a little bit more how to do job evaluations and post-offer tests and FCEs, the whole suite of services that I work with, even work conditioning. But when I was on site, honestly, we couldn't afford tools. Nobody would buy them for us. The company wouldn't buy them. The company wouldn't buy them. So I used the back of a reflex hammer. I mean, honestly, that was my go-to. I didn't have anything else, and it worked. You know, so to have an actual tool, it's brilliant.
Yeah.
I prefer the all-in-ones. I'm friends with some of the tool disruptors in the area. I know their story, and honestly, it's any sort of mechanism to do myofascial release is certainly helpful. But I love the Mohawk. That's my favorite, really.
That is mine too. Honestly, it's
really
the best. I've never felt a tool like that. It handles well. I have a hard time saying exactly what I mean, but
I know,
like just holding it in your hand, the weight of it, the size, the shape of it, it just fits perfectly. You can hold it in any position you want to. It's fantastic.
And even the red cover, the red rubber cover. I love that for scar releases. It's just, if you need that traction, it's fantastic.
And the attachments on top of it. Yeah. We need like a tool belt that we sell with that just so you can look cool while you're.
One of my, I used to leave my scissors everywhere. I swear to God, I would leave my scissors everywhere. I taught a class of 50 in Chicago and, I had four OTs in the room and the last, I swear a half hour of the course, they weren't breaking out into the labs. And I'm like, is there a problem over here? I was a little upset. And I kind of, you know, you become close with the people in your class, right? I mean, you have a great rapport. And I'm like, what are you guys doing? And I was obviously joking, being upset. But they actually were making me a scissor holder that attached to my belt. All out of rock tape. Three different colored of rock tape. It was all – I'm like – you guys are unbelievable. So I do bring it around every once in a while, but because of a class of 50 in a room, you know, you can't get to everybody and you do a demonstration, you leave your stuff everywhere. So they're like, use the tool scissor belt. So
don't forget cool. yourself. You know why, Brett?
Why?
Because I do that too. I have my own scissors set out in front of me.
Oh yeah.
Start doing my demos and then I put it somewhere and then I walk away and then I look like a fool on my knees with a strip of tape and like half applied. And then I'm like, oh, my scissors go.
Who stole my scissors?
And then sometimes you remember how like your grandmother used to lose her glasses on the top of her head.
Right.
I do that with scissors. They're in my pocket.
Yep.
So,
or they're under your left foot. Right.
Yeah. Or the right under. I always joke. It's so funny that you said they made that for you. I always joke. We should make a holster and I would totally wear it.
I would.
But I would have to have like five different holsters with five pairs of scissors because I would still lose the scissors.
Oh, more like, a wonderful hairstylist has multiple scissors. They're like, yeah, you just pull them out like a gun holster. Except for scissors.
Just get like a tack vest or something like that.
There you go. Now we're talking.
So you've been kind of transitioning a little bit, you said, into kind of teaching a lot of the different job analysis and the testing and things like that, too. Is that something I'm very familiar with? It. Can you give us a kind of an idea of what it entails to test some of these workers and just make sure they're fit?
Sure. Yeah. We work with the latest we've been doing for the last year that I'm kind of managing a couple different programs. One was a major insurance company doing ergonomic evaluations telephonically, which I thought was going to be a challenge, but turns out it works really well. Uh-huh. But the job evaluations, I get pulled into major projects around the country. And the latest one has been, a couple of them with municipalities and evaluating every job in a township, from electricians to painters to their wastewater treatment plant. I mean, I just did a one in Denver, the Denver wastewater treatment plant. I mean, so every job in the wastewater treatment plant. So when I get pulled into these projects, I bring somebody else along with me to train them, so that they get experience and they understand the process. But, yeah, it's figuring out what people do all day long. It's not challenging, but it's when you finish, it's and maybe you do 2 to 5 jobs a day, depending on how complex they are. But you feel like you just finished a final exam because you're learning new stuff. You're trying to document in the computer. You're listening, processing, and obviously taking a boatload of measurements. Force gauges are certainly utilized. My favorite is that we have to push this 2,000-pound cart. Wow. Yeah, it's okay. It may weigh 2,000 pounds, but it's got this really cool invention called wheels. So like a car, it's only about 125 pounds of force to push a ton and a half car. You actually have to use a force gauge to determine push pull. And it's amazing what some people actually have to do for work to lift.
What's some of the weird things that you've seen, if you can call them weird?
Think of to compress asphalt, like a jumping jack or even a jackhammer. They're 90 to 120 pounds and they've got to pull them out of a truck, usually by themselves. Just weird stuff that they have to lift. Some of the huge dozers, I mean, they have teeth on them that are just huge. They can weigh 90 pounds, one of those teeth alone. And they have to replace them because they get ground down. So,
oh my gosh.
Yeah. It's, I got into, through school doing physical labor, working for a moving company. So I do know physical work, firsthand. And that's why I can usually, understand exactly what somebody's going through, even if I haven't experienced it before. So,
you know, it's a really good point to make too. I was just saying this to one of my classes, is like, we talk about movement and the way that we are nowadays, movement often gets related to specifically exercise all the time. And, you know, people talk about form with exercise. And I thought about that the other day, just getting up from the floor with my son, is I just got up. I didn't like prep myself and make sure my feet were perfectly set and make sure, you know, my spine was perfectly erect and everything. I just got up.
Yeah.
And like, this is a perfect example of these people aren't thinking about, and that might sound bad, they're not thinking about how they're moving. They're just moving.
They just do it.
They just do it. Yeah. Yep. So it's something that we have to emphasize a lot with people, is like, you're just built to move. You need to be able to do that. But when pain comes on, you know, that's when something has broken down. So that's what we're trying to figure out. But I mean, do you necessarily talk about like the form? I mean, you mentioned it a little bit with lifting, and that's a big thing too. But what do you say to people when it comes down to like, hey, you're good to go. Just, you know, do your thing. What kind of tips are you giving them?
It's constant education. Honestly, whether it's, if somebody has I don't want to go back to the hand, but if somebody has a forearm issue, if they have an elbow issue, they have to keep their wrist in neutral when they're working with anything, whether they're eating. You can't eat with a wrist in full flexion because that's just going to aggravate your situation. So it's constantly looking at a neutral posture. It's constantly looking about almost biofeedback. If you feel something, you know, honestly, you have to take a look at what you're doing incorrectly. Same goes with I got a question today from a clinician doing an ergonomic evaluation for a secretary that keeps getting injured. Look, if she's reaching up and over and she's got a shoulder decompression, she just had surgery, you either have to move the printer or tell her to stand up. And they're like, you can't do that. I'm like, yeah. Well, then she'll never get better. I mean, you have to accept what's given to you and make accommodations, like it or not. Yeah.
Yeah. We talk about compensation all the time with how the body works. It's almost like you have to compensate in life.
You do.
Change like that.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And it's the biopsychosocial approach, right? But
yeah.
There are week-long courses on this stuff, right? And I find it fascinating that people are actually taking courses on it, because it was probably a third of the OT coursework that we had.
Really?
Almost, yeah. Okay. it's pretty much it.
How are you incorporating that? Because that's such a huge aspect of our education. You know, you had mentioned, you talked about it just now, you know, it's talking about, it sounds like you're just very straight with people as well too. But when someone is, you alluded to it a little bit earlier, when someone is potentially injured and it can, I guess for lack of a better term, threaten their job, you know, what kind of discussion do you have with them? You know, what do you have to do to really kind of get them to kind of come on board with your treatments and then make sure that they're following all your instructions? I guess their motivation is enough for that, but is there any more that you need to do?
Well, it is a lot about their motivation, because again, their job may be one thing. People live to work or work to live, one or the other, right? And
yeah.
And most of the time, it's you know, they need money to do other stuff, whether it's raise their kid and or do whatever they want to do for fun. You have to figure out what that is and incorporate that, whether it's into their treatment or into understanding how they need to move better so they can do that. And again, it's just a little bit of it's more personal. I think you have to get personal with somebody. I mean, you're already putting their hands on them, so how much more personal do you need to get, right?
Good point.
So, I mean, you have to ask the right questions. We talk about using motivational interviewing techniques. Open-ended questions. It's a whole process. It was originally started for people that were in addictions, but there's a medical use for it. It's a way of asking open-ended questions to get literally behavioral changes. And it is really effective. It's really complex, and most clinicians are not very good about it. It's like, you know, smoking's wrong, just stop. Well, that's not going to actually get people to stop, right? There's a way of asking questions to gain curry their favor, to make them change their own mind, is what it's all about. But it's really interesting, and yeah, I'm no expert.
When you're an expert, you don't learn anything new, right?
I think you're right. I'm never the smartest guy in the room. I tell people that all the time.
We know. Everybody in Rock Tape knows how we feel about that stuff. So, are you originally from the Boston area? You went to Springfield College.
Originally from Connecticut. Okay. Went to school at Springfield College, 2 degrees there. It's the we invented a little sport called basketball.
Heck yeah.
And it's the only sport I prefer not to play.
I know everything I need to know. I came from where.
When I can't do a layup, it's embarrassing. No, I can do a layup, but it's just something I just never you want me to ski, skydive, whatever, surf, sail, I'll do it. Triathlons, I'm in. Just don't let me play basketball.
Don't make me dribble, jump, and in the basket.
Yeah. So New England is where I I hail from. Yeah, but living in the Philadelphia area, I'm west of Philadelphia. So
born and raised.
Yeah, I'm between Lancaster and King of Prussia, if those are helpful. So it's fairly bucolic. I live near a lake. Windsor.
That was my poor attempt at a Fresh Prince of Bel Air.
I love it.
I think it completely died. So hopefully someone listening to this is laughing. At least one person is laughing right now.
I probably talked over you and I didn't hear it. So yeah.
No, it's okay. you should be talking over me as the guest. So Brett, where are you going to be coming? It's towards the end of the year, so we're not necessarily going to be all over the place soon. You're in Charlotte this weekend, so that's obviously not anything anybody listening to this can go to. But where are you going to be in the coming weeks towards the end of the year?
I am in Green Bay next weekend. So, yeah, who chooses to go to Green Bay in the middle of December? Beginning of December. I do. I really love traveling the country and seeing the food, the people. I think it's fascinating, and that's kind of why we do what we do. But and they've got a cool football team. So Green Bay next weekend, and I'm actually in upstate New York, Canton, New York, February 23rd and 24th.
Nice.
After we go to the symposium in Canton.
You're going to go from hot to cold quite a bit.
You know, that's the deal.
Have you been to Green Bay?
I have never been to Green Bay. I'm looking forward to it, actually.
It is worth it. If you don't go to a game, it is worth it to at least drive by Lambeau Field.
And cool.
I've been to, we talked about this before our open, I've worked at Synergy Fitness teaching over there. Shout out to Scotty a couple times. And Green Bay is really interesting to me because it is essentially it's like a small suburb in a very residential, very like, you know, Midwest suburban residential, not even like brand newer houses, but like houses that have been there for a while. And then you just go a block and there's this gigantic stadium of this classic, well-known championship football team. It's amazing to me that this town, because it's like this weird dichotomy all on one block.
It's a town, right? I mean, it's not this huge metropolis. It's
exactly
a town that supports this football team.
Yeah. Think about like just any suburb you've ever been to. And it's just like, oh, look up. Oh, yeah, that's the stadium. It's where our championship football team is.
That's awesome. And I've always loved that they play in the snow. I mean, I have this, it doesn't matter. I mean, I New England was terrible when I was living in New England. So I've been a Philly fan, an Eagles fan since I've been there. But honestly, I've always loved the Packers because you get somebody on their home field and it starts snowing and they're losing. They lose their mind. They can't do anything. Their whole game plan goes crap to bed.
Bears fan, I am begrudgingly.
Correct.
I'm begrudgingly okay with the Packers in the fact that they are a talented team. However, as a Bears fan, I cannot say that I like them.
You know, it's the deal.
That's the deal. We know how it is, right?
Awesome.
So, Brett, where can people find you on social media?
So social media, I'm actually looking to branch out a little bit and start a different one. I have a handle right now that is Sanders Brett One, and that is on Instagram. And I think I'm going to put a new handle out and do a little bit more education on a more regular basis. Right now, it's kind of pictures of travel and rock tape life, and some class work. But I really need to ramp up my game a little bit. And
Your Instagram is actually pretty cool because you do a lot of traveling and you were, where was the most tropical place you were at recently?
Probably Costa Rica.
Yeah. I saw some of those pictures, man. And you had said you do a little bit of surfing there. You got some surfing done there, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. It was the elusive surf picture finally was taken. I picked up surfing later in life at about, you know, late 20s, early 30s. Again, skiing all my life, but this is a little different when you have changing condition, like every single time the wave comes in. But I absolutely love it. And
cool.
It's kind of like a religion. If I wish I were closer to the water. But I finally got a picture, and yeah, it was pretty cool.
Oh, it didn't happen if it's not on social media.
Yeah, you know, you're right.
Well, Brett, thank you so much for joining me, man. That was a great conversation. If anybody is looking to take a course with Brett, check out rocktape.com. Definitely, if you can, try to get out to Green Bay. Probably not going to be easy in that short amount of time after this is launched. But check out Brett for next year, January, February, and beyond with that. And check him out on Instagram at SandersBrett1 and look out for those amazing surf pictures and a new hand.
Brett, you're the best, John. Thanks for having me on. Man. I appreciate it.